Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie. This is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us there as well. Tell us what we're doing well and what you think we should be doing more of and maybe less of. Today, we are talking with Alex Epstein. He is the president of the Center for Industrial Progress, and he's the author of the great 2014 book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. And we're going to be talking to him about Donald Trump, President-elect Trump's energy policy, what's good about it, what seems kind of cockeyed, and what would be better from an actual libertarian perspective. Alex, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So let's start with talking about Trump's policy. As he is kind of one of the big things that he talked about when he was running for president against Hillary Clinton in particular was he's going to bring back the coal jobs. He's going to open up coal mines in a way that Hillary had actually bragged about shutting down coal mines. But do we have a clear sense of what Donald Trump's energy policy is really all about?
He definitely has not said as much specifically about energy as he has about other fields. Certainly, he's also been criticized for not saying specific enough things about other fields, which I'll let other people handle. But what's interesting is that what he has said about energy, I believe policy-wise, is the best of any president since Reagan in terms of being an advocate of Americans being free to reach their full energy potential, particularly through the development of energy from fossil fuels, i.e. hydrocarbons. Mm-hmm. I think the coal claim in particular is problematic in certain ways that I'm happy to talk about. But in general, the idea that we've got this enormous amount of raw hydrocarbon material and we've got this amazing developing technology that includes hydraulic fracturing that individuals and companies could use to harness it and benefit from it. And it's currently under control substantially by an administration that vowed to end the tyranny of oil in 2007 when Obama was running.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk about that because, I mean, all of this is set against the backdrop really of almost the past decade or so where the United States has effectively become energy independent, right? I mean, it's a long sought goal and, you know, where we would be a net exporter of fossil fuels, right, or of energy one way or another. And we've basically accomplished that despite the fact that the Obama administration has been pretty proactive against various kinds of drilling operations, both on land and offshore. But fracking and other types of technologies have kind of proceeded apace, right?
Yeah, there's a story that I can't verify, but that I've been told by a couple of CEOs, which is that around 2007, 2008, they went to talk to Obama and Stephen Chu, who was the energy secretary at the time, and said to them, look, we have this amazing suite of technologies around shale energy, around getting oil and gas from this previously useless form of rock, and now we have these amazing technologies. And what they basically said is, well, Stephen Chu tells us we're going to have a revolution in batteries. We've got all these promising companies like Solyndra, and we don't need that. Plus, we want the age of oil to end in our time, which is what Obama said in a speech in Detroit, where he also analogized the oil industry to communists and fascists. He said, just as the age of oil, just as we ended communism and fascism, so we need to end the age of oil. So my view on the whole shale revolution, which I think has been the most economically positive revolution of our time, is that we were lucky that the politicians didn't know about it. So our energy prosperity has recently depended upon the ignorance of politicians who would have otherwise stopped it. And that's a very bad state to be in terms of your potential.
Talk a little bit about the shale revolution, because that's what we're talking about are things that are happening up in around Williston, North Dakota, slant drilling in Texas, fracking moving into, I guess, what we would call the industrial Midwest or the Northeast, places like Ohio, Pennsylvania, upstate New York. What are the contours of this, of the way that the shale revolution has reshaped our energy supply and demand?
Just so people get a sense of what we're talking about when we talk about shale, we have this general idea of oil, and there's oil in the ground, and we think of it as this uniform thing and this fixed thing. But really what there are different oils, different forms of hydrogen and carbon that can potentially be in liquid form that exist in ways that are naturally much easier to get or much harder to get. So at first we had oil at 69.5 feet in Titusville, Pennsylvania. There was a lot of natural pressure. It was an amazing accomplishment at the time, but now it would be super easy to get. But that was just a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the potential oil resource in the ground. And what we've done over time is we've taken unusable potential resources and we've turned them into usable. And for decades and decades and decades, this type of rock called shale, which broadly speaking is often the source for other forms of oil, from looser, more migrating forms of oil, that's been this dream. Because if you could get to that, there's tons of hydrocarbon resource in it, but how do you get it because it's so tightly packed? And to give one historical example, one of the heroes in Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, which came out in 1957, is a character named Ellis Wyatt, and his signature accomplishment is to get oil from shale. And this is what the industry has actually been doing through a series of innovations that most prominently involve breaking open the rock in a certain way using water instead of, say, melting the rock, which would be much less energy efficient. By doing that, but also by being able to exactly know where to put the powerful streams of water. Just all this amazing modern technology. But the way I think of it is somebody figured out how to take a rock that's 6,000 feet underground and use it to charge your iPhone. That's what's happening.
Now, I'm looking at data from your 2014 book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. Between 1980 and 2012, you note that in the United States alone, that oil consumption went up by about 8.7%, natural gas up by 28.3%, coal up by 13%, 12.6%. What kind of effect did that have? I mean, one of the reasons why, I expect why Obama and Stephen Chu were talking about we want to end oil is because oil is dirty. Oil is a form of fuel, or when it gets transformed into electricity, it causes a lot of pollution. What was going on in America at the same time that our oil, gas, and coal consumption was ratcheting up pretty quickly in terms of pollution?
With energy, with any technology, we always need to look at the benefits we get from it, including the unique benefits that we might not be able to get from other technologies, and also different risks and side effects. And when you hear terms like dirty versus clean, it's often a very superficial characterization in that they're not looking at, say, the process of getting the materials for wind turbines or solar panels, the process of disposing of them. So that's just a giveaway that somebody has a superficial view, because what you're always dealing with is degrees of these things. You're dealing with degrees of cleanliness, really degrees of safety. That's the key issue. So that's one aspect. But then the other aspect you indicated is there's this whole issue, not just of how much side effect or how much byproduct or how much risk is there, but what's the benefit? And in this case, the benefit of energy and energy being more affordable and more reliable is that every individual, directly or indirectly, is empowered, because energy in the energy industry is the industry that powers every other industry. Energy is really our ability to use machines to improve our lives. And the reason we're prosperous is because we live in a machine-based civilization rather than a manual labor based civilization. So the more plentiful, the more affordable, the more reliable energy is, the more we can do in every aspect of life. And a lot of what the Moral Case for Fossil Fuels documents is that with things you might not expect, such as clean water or the advance of knowledge or protection from climate, having affordable energy helps all of those.
Well, let's talk about the moral case for fossil fuels a bit. You write in the book early on that first off, the moral case, making the moral case, you say that I hold human life as the standard of value. Talk a little bit about that and how, because the book in many ways is, even as it's a moral case, it makes a lot of kind of cost-benefit analyses. What do you mean when you say that that human life is the standard of value that you're kind of using to judge how effective or how moral or immoral or, kind of beneficial a particular technology is?
We often use moral terminology like good and bad when discussing things. And whenever you use that terminology, whether we admit it or not, there's a question of by what standard are you saying that it's good or bad? How do you measure good or bad? And this is the terminology that I use, which Ayn Rand also used, mm-hmm. is called standard of value. So that's by what standard are you measuring good and bad? And what's interesting about the issue of energy and also many other issues that strongly involve our relationship to our environment is that the working standard that is in use is not actually what maximizes what I call human flourishing. We might think that we really care about that, but if we look at our methodology in action, if we look at what we're prioritizing, our standard is actually often to minimize human impact. So maximizing human flourishing versus minimizing human impact. And those are very, very different things. And I like to run through examples when I speak to audiences like, okay, well, minimizing human impact, you might think that sounds good as a way of thinking about morality and our environment.
And this is kind of the Boy Scout ideal of when you take away or break camp, that you leave the place exactly as you found it or a little bit better off, right? That you traipse through the world, through the natural world with a light touch.
Right, but that policy in that context is somehow universal. Mm-hmm. And what I ask people is, well, if we had that policy, would we have ever turned a patch of dirt and trees into New York City? Mm-hmm. Well, obviously not. We weren't leaving it as we found it. We were changing it dramatically. Or would you ever have a kid? Well, no, that is about the biggest impact you could imagine. And then I'll ask, well, if it's supposedly about environment, which is a better country if you want to minimize impact, North Korea or South Korea? And they'll say, well, North Korea, and which is pretty jarring. And then I'll say, well, which country has a better environment? And they'll say, well, obviously South Korea. So there's something very wrong with this as an ideal, yet we use it as an ideal. We use it as a metric. And the problem is that it's treating impact as the key issue, whereas impact is an aspect of what benefits human flourishing. So we want to maximize our positive impacts on nature for human beings, and we want to minimize our negative impacts to human beings. And if we think of it that way, then whether we're thinking of CO2 emissions or particulate matter or energy poverty, we're going to look at all the considerations in the context of humans. And I think this issue actually is the key to a lot of debates, such as what they call the climate change debate. We're not clear on our standard rather than there's really a debate over, say, climate models.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because obviously, climate change is a huge issue. And I was just watching a documentary on TV that was about UFO, a guy who investigates people who believe in UFOs. And he was saying he's a skeptic. And, you know, he mentioned in the same breath as UFO, nuts, people who believe in UFOs, that, there's also climate deniers, which is a phrase that gets used a lot as if people are denying the idea that there's such a thing as climate. But when it comes to climate change and when it comes to anthropocentric impact on the Earth's climate, you're not saying that burning fossil fuel doesn't have impact, doesn't have effects, both good and bad. But what you're saying is that we're looking at it, or we're kind of evaluating it on a cockeyed spectrum, where we're saying the big, if you're all you're talking about is how much CO2 are we releasing into the atmosphere, or we're trying to measure CO2, that's just missing the big story, which is really how it affects human lives and allows for or retards human flourishing.
Yes. So imagine that you have two parents who are trying to decide whether and how to vaccinate their children. And so they're looking for information on this. And they find something very strange, which is that they never can find a full context assessment of what are the benefits and risks of vaccines compared to the alternatives? Instead, all they can find is discussion of vaccine side effects. And so you have an intergovernmental panel of vaccine side effects. And that's all people talk about is vaccine side effects. And they're inclined to vaccinate their kids in a certain way. And then they start being called vaccine side effect deniers because they say, well, you're going to use vaccines, but don't you know that they have side effects? And aren't you a vaccine side effect denier? And you'd think, well, there's something really wrong about that. And the thing that's wrong is that you can't just look at the potential negatives of something if your concern is to benefit your kid or to benefit human beings in general. You have to look at the full context, which means both positives and negatives. You have to have a clear standard, which in this case is the well-being of your kid or, you know, the well-being of human beings more broadly. You have to look at them with precision. If you say vaccine side effects, do you mean full-blown autism or do you mean a rash? And what you see with the climate issue is people don't look at it as an aspect of fossil fuels, as a potential side effect of fossil fuels, the effect of CO2. They don't look at it that way. So they ignore the positives, and then they are not at all clear about whether it's, you know, the equivalent of autism, which would be an Al Gore type, you know, 30-foot rise in sea levels over several decades.
Florida disappearing, England disappearing, all that kind of stuff.
Right. They're not clear on whether it's that or whether it's, say, 2 feet over 80 years or 90 years, which is historically, you know, very uninteresting. And sea level rise has dramatically slowed. You just look at Wikipedia over the past 20,000 years. And the enterprise of the moral case is to say, okay, let's use a rational thinking method. Let's have a clear metric of how we're going to choose what's good and bad. And then let's look at carefully at the full context of positives and negatives. And once you do that, you just see that the alleged negatives are either very overblown or sometimes they're the reverse. And in climate, it's the reverse because the effect of CO2 is just very uninteresting. But the effect of having a lot more energy, of a lot more people having a lot more energy, allows us to deal with climate, which is naturally very dangerous. It's not our friend, allows us to build a durable civilization and run a durable civilization. So every number we have about how safe we are from climate we're safer and safer every year.
And well, first off, so the catastrophic kind of scenarios that are in certain climate models, you think those are extremely unlikely to happen. That's one of the bets that you're making, right?
I wouldn't call it a bet because I believe that the burden of proof is on someone who asserts something. So if you are making a claim about the future, it's just like, well, a psychic says something, and I say, well, I'm betting against the psychic. And that might seem like a crazy comparison, right. But you know, most models that people have in predicting the future are very wrong. I mean, they simply don't work. They're taking on very difficult problems, even if the problems are solvable, and often they're taking on unsolvable problems given current knowledge. And often it's the most irresponsible people and often inept people who claim to have solutions to these unsolvable problems. So one of my colleagues, Eric Dennis, who's a physicist, also has a lot of experience building mathematical models, he once analogized it to, well, you could be the best person at building a model or a plan of how to make a spaceship to go to Alpha Centauri, but you still don't really know how to do it. And so the person who claims that, you don't say, well, he's the world authority on getting to Alpha Centauri. You say, well, this guy is kind of a crank. And the question with these models is, on what basis are they doing this? And what I note in the book is that the basic mechanism that we know about the relationship between CO2 and the warmth in atmosphere is a diminishing or logarithmic effect, which means that every new molecule of CO2 adds less warmth than the last, and that the claims that there's some that thus increasing CO2 levels portends doom, that has a lot of speculation in it that has not been validated by the models that are based on that thinking. And in fact, those models have been invalidated.
And that's because a lot of the models or most of the models that get taken seriously by important thinkers and whatnot really are over predict where we should be by now. And I know in a kind of more banal way, you have you quote predictions by people like Paul Ehrlich and people like Bill McKibben and others who you know, by this time, or even 10 years ago or 15 years ago, whole parts of the world wouldn't exist anymore because of types of climate change that obviously never happened.
Yeah, well, the first chapter of the book is called The Secret History of Fossil Fuels, and it deals with the issue of track record. If you ever have people making dramatic predictions, you have to be on the premise that this is something very hard to do. And one thing that's great is if you can know the track record of these particular individuals, which includes their method of thinking, and then any prediction models that they have used. And in this case, there's great news in this respect, in that the same people who are thought leaders today, or many of the same people, have been making predictions based on the same basic model of how the world works, and they've been doing it for 35 or so years. So we have a lot of evidence as to the reliability of these people and the quality of their thinking methods. And what we find is that they have not just been wrong when they've predicted things in the 70s that are, you know, that mirror so exactly what they say today. So if anyone goes to moralcaseforfossilfuels.com, you can get that chapter for free. You'll see it's just uncanny. And then it's not just that they were wrong, it's that they were reverse right. That is, they said something would happen really badly, like we'd run out of X resource, and now we have more of the resource than ever. Or they said, you know, John Holdren, Obama's top science advisor, said, well, there's going to be 1 billion people who die from climate-related famine by 2020, and yet the use of fossil fuels plus the non-climate catastrophe have made it possible for billions of new people to be fed. So it's right. Reverse right is the best term I have, because we don't really have a term for how wrong they've been. So that track record is very important in assessing things. And not only is that not raised by them, it's not raised by the media. And in fact, the media will sometimes say, I don't know where this comes from. They'll even say, well, this person has a really good track record. So they've said this of James Hansen, who's one of the catastrophists. And they say he's had a shockingly good track record. They don't give any evidence because none exists. But it's you know, if you just look at your own, just do a little Google search on quotes from somebody for the last several decades, and you should do it for me too. Like, for instance, with the peak oil scare, look at what people were saying about peak oil in 2008, 2009. Because you look at, say, Michael Lynch, whom I think is the best thinker in that field, you'll see him saying exactly what happened and being ridiculed for it. As a lesser thinker in that aspect of energy, you'll see me saying that it's ridiculous and explaining why.
And peak oil was the idea that we had reached maximum production and that it was going to be declining, you know, that we had finally started to, you know, we were really having to suck hard on the straw to get oil out of the ground. And of course, that didn't happen. There was essentially a cycle where prices went up. So people started predicting because it fit in with their theory of the end of the world and moving past fossil fuels that, okay, this was the beginning of the post-oil period. Talk a little bit about the value of cheaper energy. And if you can put it on, you had mentioned that, you know, and the book is certainly filled with excellent examples of this, but of how when energy consumption goes up, wealth goes up, and then put that in the context of how being wealthier, how does that make a country more resilient or a population more resilient against weather and against kind of climate problems, extreme weather? Talk a little bit about that, because one of the things that is amazing is how much more energy, the world is using, again, quoting from your book. Between 1980 to 2012, overall, the world increased its oil consumption by about 40%, coal by over 100%, gas by 100 natural gas by 131%. What are the benefits of more cheaper fossil fuel use?
As I mentioned, it's really universal. You can't find an area where it doesn't affect it, because the ability to have a machine do our physical work versus us having to do our physical work is just life and death. And when we have energy, what we have then is the potential to have these amazing machines that turn man into Superman. You think of that in a very literal way. It's really remarkable what we can do. And Superman's power is power. And Superman is able to do that. I mean, you know, as a fictional character, but he stores tons and tons of energy within himself. And you mentioned the realm of climate. And I find this fascinating because it's so common sense once you realize it, but we don't realize it. And by we, I include myself. And one way to think of it is this. There's a statistic called climate-related deaths, which quantifies how many people die every year from the things that are supposedly getting worse: storms, floods, drought, extreme heat, extreme cold, wildfires. And you'd think that if we were assessing what is the state of climate in terms of how is it affecting human flourishing, we would look at that number and that number would be discussed. But there's almost nobody who discusses that number. The person who popularized it a little bit is Inder Gokhlani of the Cato Institute. And he's the person who familiarized me with it. And then I think I've spread it quite a bit myself. But it's kind of crazy that we're supposedly concerned about climate, and yet we don't actually quantify the effect on human beings, which goes, I believe, to the idea that we're not really concerned about human beings. Right. We just think it's wrong for us to change things. So if we hear that we're putting more CO2 in the atmosphere, we just think we violated the commandment, let's not change things, versus we can show that it's a problem. But what we see is that, hey, wait a second, nature doesn't give us a safe climate that we make dangerous. It gives us a really dangerous climate that we need to make safe. And you just think of it in a common sense way. Look at all of these ways in which we've taken the naturally dangerous climate and made it safe. I'm sitting in San Francisco right now. I have engaged in massive climate change by renting an apartment that changes the nature of my atmosphere every single second I am in this apartment. It is, my climate is dramatically different to a far greater degree than any alleged outside change that's going on. So the effective atmosphere we live in is completely artificially modified. And then I'm protected from the elements by having sturdy housing. And I'm protected from extreme heat and extreme cold by heating and air conditioning. And you can go on and on and on. And it's just remarkable. And what this manifests itself in is that in the 1930s even, which is a somewhat industrialized time, but around the world, you have the modern equivalent of, in many years, 10 million climate-related deaths a year. And now we'll typically have 30,000 climate-related deaths a year. So climate is actually a climate danger, which is a much more precise term than climate change, is not a problem that's been created by fossil fuels. It's a problem that's been solved by technology, including fossil fuels.
Well, and talk about, you know, I was checking out some other numbers, and in 2016, essentially, the United States will, which has produced many, many more things, and as I noted before, energy consumption is way up from where it was 20, 30 years ago. We will emit the same amount of carbon as we did in 1992. And that's mostly due to fracking and kind of shale, the shale revolution that you've talked about. So, and there isn't a city in America where the air quality and the water quality is not better than it was in 1980, essentially. I mean, you know, there are some specific examples, I guess, with water like Flint, Michigan, which has everything to do with political stupidity and nothing to do with technology or irreversible natural order. Is it the case, though? I mean, can the world as a whole keep burning more fuel and still, like, everywhere in the world, like, air pollution will become less? You know, talk a little bit about what is the technology, what is the innovation that allows for that?
The answer is definitely. I do separate CO2 from other what we can call pollutants. Mm-hmm. Even that's misleading, because the issue with everything is there's a certain threshold at which something starts to become dangerous. And then there's a certain threshold, you know, at that threshold, it can become innocuous, or even it can become better. Like, you can be better off. You know, see studies of kids where certain amounts of dirt are good for them. And then if they are exposed to too many germs, then that can be a big issue. And the issue of threshold is just extremely misunderstood. And the dominant theory is called the linear no threshold view, which is the premise that, well, if something is harmful in some quantity, it must be harmful in any quantity. And so what you have is very, very small amounts of emissions thanks to technology today. This is not like the London fog in the 1940s, which is a real problem, or even modern China, which isn't nearly as bad as London fog, but still really an issue. Right. We have in the United States some of the cleanest air in the world, and you have all these bogus studies, or almost all bogus studies, claiming that this is a huge source of death versus, you know, the real sources of death being poverty-related or behavior-related. And the reason that we can have this incredibly clean air, including around many modern coal plants, is that what technology enables us to do is it enables us to take the raw energy in the coal and extract it in such a way that it doesn't have nearly as much byproduct that's put in a place that's harmful to human beings. So the way we think about energy is very wrong, because we think about it as just a material that we use as energy. But really, every form of energy is a process that begins with a set of raw materials. And then the key is, how do you combine those in such a way that we can get it cheaply, plentifully, reliably, and healthily or safely? And theoretically, you can get coal, you could get the energy from coal in 100% clean way, and you could get energy in the form of wind turbines in a way that killed tens of thousands of people in making it or even in deploying it in various ways. So what we see with any technology, you can make safer and cleaner over time. And with this one, what's great is it's very efficient in terms of its resource usage, in terms of producing cheap, plentiful, reliable energy, you know, as compared to what I call the unreliables, solar and wind, which are dealing with these unreliable inputs, and that just creates a huge mess everywhere they're deployed. So you have this thing, and we're getting good at dealing with the byproducts. And I wish that if we lived in a more pro-human flourishing world, what would happen is people would be even more obsessed with improving the way that we burn these things, the way we extract that energy. They'd be excited about that versus the unreliables going down by a few cents, and yet I'm still forced to pay for my neighbor's solar panels, and every single country that uses these things on a large scale basically doubles its energy price.
Can you talk a little bit, in a quick way about how are solar panels, for instance, how are they a bad alternative to existing fossil fuel technology? Or are they something that over time will become more reliable and less harmful? You know, what is your case against solar panels, say?
One thing that is implicit in discussions among free marketers, which both of us are, is that the kinds of decisions we're talking about should be made by free individuals. And this should be the basis of energy policy, that you should have freedom of competition among energy producers and freedom of choice among energy consumers, and that you have – and the basic way to do this is by protecting property rights, because you protect the right of individuals and companies to use land to develop energy on, and you also protect their right to be on their land without contamination by others. That's like the broadly schematic context in which these energy decisions are made. And the reason to talk about the virtues of fossil fuels and the alleged vices of fossil fuels is because we've been so misled about this, where we're taught to think that to use fossil fuels is to violate people's rights in a wholesale way. And thus there's this case that, well, we need to do something dramatic about CO2, or we really shouldn't be able to use it at all, because in the aggregate, it's violating everyone's rights. And what the moral case for fossil fuels is doing is really looking, well, is this really such a technology that's just so toxic that it's violating everyone's rights? And then you see, no, absolutely not. It's unbelievably moral to be used. And thus, there's certainly not a political justification for putting in this category of some menace to society. So it's to say that there's a moral case for fossil fuels is not to say that other things are bad. But in understanding the particular morality of fossil fuels, it is valuable to look at the potential alternatives, particularly if you have concerns about the emissions. And then looking at the potential alternatives, you see this very curious thing that the most promising alternatives that are not CO2 emitting, nuclear power and hydroelectric power, are opposed by the people who claim to care about CO2. And they're generally supported by supporters of fossil fuels. I'm certainly a big supporter. And then yet these two technologies, solar and wind, which I call the unreliables, because they deal with these intermittent inputs, which means that you can't count on them, and you can't count on them in very, very dramatic ways, which means they have to be essentially 100% replicated by the actual network, which makes them essentially dead weight and unnecessary wherever they're deployed, and that adds cost to every grid. So you can see this is the fundamental problem, and there's a lot that you would have to do to deal with that, including some magical storage thing. And I talk about this in chapter two of the book, but it's just a mess. But what I want to point out is, why are we so obsessed with the sun and the wind as sources? And it goes back to this idea of minimizing impact. It's allegedly minimally impactful. It's allegedly natural to use the sun and the wind, and it's bad to dam a river because that's changing nature. It's bad to create man-made radiation to generate energy because that's changing nature. It's bad to use energy that adds more CO2 to the atmosphere because that's changing nature. And allegedly, solar and wind aren't. And of course, everything we do changes nature. Right. So if solar and wind ever became practical, the green movement would oppose them. So the reason that they support them is because there's only one form of energy that the green movement has ever supported, and that is imaginary energy.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you start talking about it in that way. I was thinking of Samuel Coleridge as a poem about the Aeolian harp as the ultimate instrument, because it's a mechanism that the wind blows through it and makes beautiful music. And so it's totally somehow natural, even though it's obviously an artificial construct, a construct of human activity. And there's a lot of romanticism in a very negative and kind of naive way in environmentalism, that what we want is an imagined world that has very little to do with the world that we necessarily live in. Talk for a second about, in terms of technological innovation, what is the role, and this is more of a kind of libertarian nerd, market nerd question, what is the role of the government saying, you were talking about property rights and whatnot, the air is not necessarily a commons, but it's very hard to figure out who's polluting, and then how do you, how would you bring them to court in some kind of common law situation? What is the role, positive or negative, of certain types of government mandates, whether it's a catalytic converter or certain types of scrubbers on smokestacks to clean up air? Would coal companies on their own, would gas fracking companies on their own, would energy companies on their own say, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to keep making the technology cleaner, smarter, cheaper, better? Have government edicts and mandates had beneficial effects on the air that we breathe, the water that we drink?
Advocates of government intervention always take credit for anything positive that happens in the realm that they have taken over, which I find just very weird. So let's say, you take the case of government run universities, and there's some good graduate from that, and they say, well, look, it was great that we did this because there was this great graduate. But what about what would have happened had people been free? Where would that individual have gone? What kind of schools would exist, et cetera, et cetera? So there's an issue of, well, how does the government protect, in this case, us against contamination of air by different industrial processes? And the government has taken action in that realm. And that action has helped people in that, because it's done something in that realm. There's been some good in that. That is, some of the actions it's taken have cleaned up some people's air. The question is, does it have remotely the right approach? And is that the approach to use going forward? And I favor a property rights-based approach. And there are many libertarians that disagree with me on this. Mm-hmm. And there's an interesting back and forth between me and Brian Kaplan of mm-hmm. George Mason, who's a good friend and wrote a very positive review of the book, but he raised some interesting criticisms. And we went back and forth on, like, if CO2 was an issue, would a CO2 tax be good? Mm-hmm. And in general, I think that the first thing with any of these issues is to identify what is the actual threshold of danger, like to be really clear on what constitutes an actually harmful level, because people tend to assume this idea that, well, any amount of it is bad, any amount of it is taxed, should be taxed or whatever. And I want to know, okay, with air, to the extent of our knowledge, what's actually a risk that goes above the normal level of background risk that we deal with all the time? So that's one question that has to be incorporated. Another question has to be is, how necessary is this risk given current technology? So let's say you took London in the 1800s using coal. If you had held them to our air quality standards, you'd just say, okay, don't use coal. And they would have, to a man, objected to that, because they would have said, well, no, we have a right to act to benefit our lives, and this technology is essential to our lives, and it's inevitable that we have a certain amount of byproduct given technology. Whereas as the technology evolves, then we, you know, then we can live, we can have the energy, and we can have less pollution. So there's a contextual element, but you always have to look at what's the positive involved in the process, not just what's the potential negative. And with the negative, you have to be clear on the threshold. And there, I think there can be a role with these aggregate cases where it's one individual doesn't do anything by burning coal, but in the aggregate, we can create a problem. I think there's a role of the government, you know, figuring out, hey, is there a way for this to be reduced? But I think it does it on the basis of pseudoscience. I tend to be in favor of actually the way that people think of cap and trade, in the sense that if you have an idea with CO2, and it's false because CO2 is not dangerous in this way, but if you have the idea that there's a certain amount of CO2 that the atmosphere can handle, that's safe, and then there's a point of danger, well, then in effect, there needs to be a legal structure such that we don't go above that. To pass a tax is a very odd way of doing it, and it's kind of messy. Mm-hmm. And I think of it more like radio spectrum. Like, we've created value there's a certain amount of CO2 bandwidth that we can use, and the first people to create value actually have the right to that. And then the next people need to find other ways of doing it, or the first people can sell their rights. Right. But in any case, you need to have the threshold. And the same thing is true. I think Ayn Rand once suggested, I'm not sure, but with LA and smog, she said, look, it doesn't bother me. I'm dubious of laws about it. But you could say, look, there's only a fixed number of, with today's technology, we're only going to allow a fixed number of cars in LA. And the people who created that value are the ones who get to do it. And that would have spurred innovation. So that's like schematically what I think is a scientific pro-human way of thinking about these things versus just let's reduce emissions in a vacuum.
Right. You have mentioned Ayn Rand several times. The magazine and website and video platform I work for is called Reason, partly in homage to her, the founder of the magazine in 1968. Lanny Friedlander was kind of an objectivist. We are heretics to many Randians. But talk a little bit about Ayn Rand and her role in your project at the Center for Industrial Progress. How does she motivate you and inspire you?
When I was 18 years old, I started reading a couple of things on the issue of environment, which just completely blew my mind. And I indicated the issue earlier, but I'll put it in a slightly different way. It was the issue that, well, environmentalism, so to speak, in its essence, says that we should minimize our impact on nature. Yet man, by his nature, survives by impacting nature. That's what we do. We use productivity is using reason to transform nature to meet our needs. So there's a movement that says the essence of human survival is bad. And that is wrong. And I was in a set of classes at the time, which had a lot of environmentalists, both on the teacher level and the student level. And I was this was such a clear idea in my mind that this is the totally wrong way of thinking, and that this is wrong. And the people whom I had learned from were, you can call them Randians or objectivists either way, but these were scholars in the tradition of Ayn Rand's thought, And I had heard of her in high school, but I really read her seriously in college, actually starting with her letters to various figures. That was kind of random. I saw it in the Duke Library. But ultimately, I read Atlas Shrugged, which for me, as for many people, was just a revelation, and in relevant to this issue in two ways. One is just that the way she thought really fascinated me, in that she would look at the world and she'd really look for commonalities among ideas and put them in very precise ways that I never heard. So she identified, for example, that a lot of our thinking about morality involved the idea that one person's need is a claim on another person's life. And however you want to analyze that, that just blew my mind. Wait, I never thought about that. Yet I've heard all these, you know, thousands of instances of discussing it, yet nobody ever united it that way. In the same way that these scholars, and I learned later she, had identified, oh, when we talk about environment, we have this premise that we should be minimizing impact. And she could think in this incredibly clear way. And that inspired me, because I've been obsessed with logic since I was a kid. And then at the same time, I also loved business, but I wasn't really into industry. And she had this book where the industrialists were heroes, the transformers of nature were heroes. And that really helped me a lot in my thinking. And then, you know, 9, 10 years later, when I became interested in energy and actually afraid of issues like the CO2 issue. So I was not at all, I didn't have this prejudgment that it was impossible that CO2 would be a problem. I was actually concerned. But I did have this context that industry is crucial to human life, that logical thinking is necessary, and that the green movement is not focused on maximizing human benefit. It's focused on minimizing human impact, and that's the opposite of maximizing human benefit. And then when I studied it, I saw, oh, the reason they're obsessed with CO2 is not because it's at a level that's really going to hurt us. It's because they think it's wrong. We have no right to change the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere.
And so that means, when you said, as I quoted earlier, I hold human life as the standard of value, you would... If there was evidence produced that massive industrial civilization was destroying human life impacting it horribly, negatively, killing people, more people than it helped, I mean, you would flip your positions, right?
Well, I already do that all the time, in the sense that industrial civilization isn't a single thing. Mm-hmm. It's the aggregate of many people's actions and many companies' actions, and producers in their decisions and consumers in their decisions do harmful things all the time. Mm-hmm. So if you take, say, the food industry, I think a lot of what the food industry produces and what people choose to consume are very harmful. But I don't react to that by saying, oh, industry is bad, mechanized right. agriculture is bad, nor do I think of it in this bizarre way, like let's be as natural as possible, that's incoherent. But I try to think, well, what promotes human flourishing? And we need political policies of freedom to give us the chance to produce the best food and to consume the best food, but it doesn't guarantee it. And so if I see, privately or publicly, right. hey, like there are these trends that we have that are damaging to life, I'll say, yeah, the industry is doing a bad thing. So yeah, and if so, thus any change in behavior or change in knowledge about the significance of, say, a form of emission, that should lead us to change our conclusion. And I think ultimately what I do in my book, and the real project that I'm undertaking, is to guide people in how to use technology for its proper purpose of promoting human flourishing. That's really the mission of my work going forward. And that means that it's not just all technology is good, all industry is good, all uses are good. We're not technophiles or industry files. We're lovers of humans who recognize that used properly, these things have amazing potential, and used improperly, they can do a lot of bad. So let's think carefully about how to use them properly.
And you really take the industry, and again, the industry, but the energy industry, many of the leading players, and certainly major oil and gas companies, to task, because you say that, you know, they seem to have bought into the argument. And you talk about companies like BP and Mobil and whatnot on their websites where they don't even mention what they do or what they produce on their web pages often, because they essentially buy the environmentalist argument that they're doing something immoral, they're doing something wrong. Have you had much of an impact, or the Center for Industrial Progress? What kind of impact have you had to get the industries that would most benefit from your framework for understanding what they're doing? I mean, are they getting on board with you, or are they more and more kind of like, well, we're not British Petroleum anymore, we're BP, and we really don't have anything to do with oil or gas or anything like that?
The American companies, I think, have been substantially affected by my work, and that's very satisfying to me. For many reasons, including just from a broader perspective, in the history of capitalism, it's been very rare that businesses take any kind of proper moral stand, certainly one involving free markets. And you know, I had this working theory when I started the Center for Industrial Progress, but I didn't know if it was true, that if I could give arguments for what an industry does well in a way that was appealing to the public and that was more appealing than their appeasing, self-evidently cowardly propaganda like the Beyond Petroleum thing. If I could give them that, that would be a financial asset to them. And I could sell it to them as messaging, both for their employees, who would be much more motivated by a message that what they do is empowering the world and what they do is not as bad as it used to be, you know, which is kind of the most inspiring message they used to have, but also inspiring the public about the potential, the opportunities that we have by using these amazing technologies. And so the past several years, one of the things I've done behind the scenes that I think is the type of thing I'm supposed to be ashamed about or hide, which I never do, I'm very proud of it, is talk a lot to companies as a guest speaker, as an advisor, about how to think about what they do. So the framework, the human flourishing framework that I use, and then show them how that's the basis of persuading other people of the goodness of what they do. And I'm always impatient about things, so I don't think it's improved as much as I want it to. But there's certainly been a lot of improvement, certainly among the young people in the industry. I think the next generation is going to be completely different. And everybody who sees this approach, the moral approach, just about everybody who's young and in the industry, they get really excited about it. So I have this, you know, sort of one indication is I am somewhat of a celebrity within that industry, which is not exciting in and of itself, but which is exciting in that a philosopher and philosophy is commanding this because it's so important, and they're starting to see it.
You know, one other thing, and I have it written out of my notes. It was on page 205. Again, you published the book in 2014. And you hypothesize that, you know, we're going to see pro-fossil fuel politicians winning over anti-fossil fuel politicians. And I'm not going to say you are responsible for the Trump victory. I'm not sure it's a good thing, but certainly that's what happened this time around. Trump was unapologetically, if not necessarily in a very informed way, pro-fossil fuel. Clinton was very anti-fossil fuel. To bring it back to Trump and to kind of wrap things up, what are your concerns about a Trump presidency and a Trump energy policy? Because, you know, even as I was thinking, as you were talking about, you know, if we went back and talked to people living in London in 1800 in the bustle of the Industrial Revolution and told them you can't burn coal and they tell us to go pound sand, in many ways, that's what the developed world is trying to do to China, which is going through an industrial revolution of its own and a transformation and has, by Western standards, terrible air quality. And a lot of people in the West want to say to China and less developed countries, you know what, you don't have access to fossil fuels because we burned them all up and you're going to screw up the planet. Trump is a nationalist. He's an economic nationalist. And half of, you know, a lot of what he ran on was China bashing or trying to screw over China, trying to squeeze China down economically. You know, does the economic nationalism of Trump bother you in terms of energy policy, or are there other concerns where you think he might get things spectacularly wrong?
I have a different view of any politician before they're elected versus after they're elected.
That's a smart way of thinking about it, for sure.
In terms of what I as an individual can do, what any individual can do, but I'm in a position, I believe, to help things. And in energy, energy is the issue where I'll just say about Trump, I think this is the issue that he is best on. So if we were talking about other issues, primarily like say trade or other things, it would not be a position maybe where I thought that I could be helpful, or at least being helpful would mean opposing the things that I disagreed with about trade. So I think that once somebody is elected, the question is really, what is their positive that we can maximize, and what is their negative that we really need to oppose? And I see a lot of people, free market people, still kind of in the, was it right to vote for Trump or Hillary? Which methodologically, that's an interesting kind of thing. But the fact is that we've got a lot of important issues on the table, and that the outcome of those issues is incredibly up in the air, much more up in the air than it would have been under Hillary. I believe it. I'm not saying I supported her or I supported Trump. I don't say so publicly, but Hillary would have, I think, made every area of the economy worse as signed, sealed, and delivered. Like that was just a guarantee. Donald Trump, in terms of what's going to happen, there's a lot that's up in the air. So my focus on energy has been, what can I do to maximize the chance of something good happening? And that's the main thing I think I can do, because I think he has pretty good policy advisors, is I'm really interested in the issue of how they explain it to the public. I think you mentioned the issue of, like, do his ideas make sense? Well, I'm concerned about, are the arguments made to the public going to make sense? Because we could have the same policy conclusion, say, about increasing fossil fuel development, but if you don't talk about the issue of CO2, if you don't talk about the issue of emissions and how that fits into your case, then you're going to alienate a lot of people and you'll have what's happened in the past, whereas they'll just quote this one tweet where he called global warming,
a Chinese hoax, right?
Yeah, hoax by China. Yeah, he's also said much more intelligent things about that, including that we have to look at what's the magnitude of it and how significant is it in the full context of the other things we have to deal with, which is exactly the right general schematic way to think about it. But I've openly offered to help any politician, and so that would include Trump, if they're interested in pro-freedom policies, which includes but is not limited to pro-fossil fuel policies, if they're interested in helping sell that and help persuade people by giving people an argument that's based on human flourishing, that's based on careful thinking about the full context, I want to help them. So I'm hoping that I can do that. I certainly do not want any kind of position within any, government or anything like that. But I'm openly eager to help with that. So that's my particular focus with Trump. Everything else that I can do or say, I think, is tiny in comparison to what I could potentially do there.
I know I would get behind any politician who actually talked in terms of human flourishing and then had policies that were even tangentially related to human flourishing. So we will leave it there. We have been talking with Alex Epstein. He is the president of the Center for Industrial Progress. We've been talking about Trump's energy policy as candidate and what might happen as president. Alex also wrote the really powerful book from 2014, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. I highly recommend reading it. Alex, thanks so much for talking to us.
Hey, thanks so much, Nick.
This has been The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us. Check us out at Reason.com as well, where we have all of our written articles as well as videos and other treats for the mind and the imagination. For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.